This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. When news broke about Anthony Bourdain's suicide, I was stunned. I've admired Bourdain, watched his TV shows, even chafed a bit at some of his messages. His decision to end his own life didn't surprise me, given the aura of independence he gave off, but it certainly got my attention. Couple that with designer Kate Spade's recent suicide, and I find myself thinking about that old maxim about famous people dying in threes, except I don't remember a case of trios dying by suicide. I found myself wondering, in a dark moment, who's going to be the third celebrity in this triad to end it all. Suicide has shaken our society. The death of Washington State University football player Tyler Helinski certainly put a human face to it. Many of us who never met him felt like we'd suffered some sort of personal loss. And so we'll spend a good chunk of this show re-airing conversations we've had about suicide. First, a few excerpts from a discussion we had in our studio in January about grieving after a suicide and how even happy families aren't spared. And then we'll hear analysis from professionals from a 2017 Spokane Public Radio forum about suicide. Our January discussion centered around one Spokane family led by community leader Phil Tyler and his wife Meg Demand.
On Monday, November 27th, my oldest son, Devin, left me a message. And the message said he had stopped by the house to drop off some cookies, because he knows his father has a sweet teeth. And he would routinely do that. And I didn't happen to be home that day. So he left them on the porch, and he left the message that said, "Hey, I stopped by, Dad, to drop off some cookies for you. Sorry I couldn't see you. I love you, Dad." And I responded back to him via text. I was testifying at a city council meeting, and I told him I was sorry that I had missed him and that I loved him too. And that was the last message I got from my son, November 27th, because that following Wednesday morning, our neighbor, a longtime friend of ours that lived across the street from my old house that my son was renting with two other friends of his, young gentlemen, they were all around the same age, 22, she called to tell me that there were several fire trucks and sheriff's deputy vehicles at my home, and that I know what was going on. And of course, I told her I did not. I asked her if she could go check and see what the situation was while I jumped in the car and ran over there. And obviously, as a parent, I had a sense of foreboding, and I texted my son, Devin, immediately, to no avail. He didn't respond. I texted him again, no response. I called him, no response. Texted him and told him to call me. By then, I was at the house. We were only about four blocks away. And as I rolled up and I saw the scene, immediately I knew something was wrong. And as I stepped out of the vehicle, I was confronted by the deputies telling me not to go into our garage. And at that point, I knew. His mother, who had been there, came running out of the house and told me that Devin had took his life. And from that point forward, obviously, my day, my life changed.
The day that it happened, I got a call from him. I was in a board meeting, and I knew, because he never calls me when I'm in a meeting. It's a strict rule with him. I won't bug you when you're at work. So I knew he was calling. Something was up. And so I went out and took the phone call, and he said, come home now. And he told me to come home to, he told me that Devin had shot himself. And at that point, I didn't know whether Devin was alive or not. The whole way home, had no idea. And I knew Devin lived in the home that we also own. And so I didn't quite know which home I was headed to, but I knew I was going to probably stop. And we're not very far apart. So, and when I pulled up and I saw the vehicles that were there, I asked on my way in if he had passed, and was told at that point. So that was my first introduction to what had actually happened. I was hoping it was an accidental shot, something like that. But, and then for me, coming from a mom who's a nurse, and when I went into crisis mode completely, and I'm also like a complete logistics person, so it was making sure that everybody was doing the right things, being nice to each other.
And as we sat there for some 4 hours, as they checked over the scene, collected evidence, etc. Many thoughts went through my mind. I wanted to crawl into a shell. I wanted to keep crying because I was crying. I didn't want to be around people. But as we left the day, and I spent some time at home just lying on my bed with my wife consoling me, I thought, you know, what am I going to do now? Luckily, Devin had left us some videotapes telling us not why he made the decision to take his life, but just for us not to grieve, for us to celebrate the 22 years we had on this earth with him, to make the 24 hours that we're given each day better.
It used to be, and in some cases still is, that media wouldn't write stories about individual suicides. Guy goes to the Monroe Street Bridge, throws himself off. Nobody would know about it, except maybe those poor souls who watched him jump. But with more high-profile suicides, the issue is becoming more visible, and we're reporting on them. Some have used words like crisis and epidemic to describe it. Is suicide really more prevalent? Dr. Matt Layton is the Clinical Education Director for Mind, Brain, and Behavior at the WSU College of Medicine.
Thankfully, even though it's increasing in frequency, it's still a rare event from the standpoint of it happens more than we might realize. For example, in Spokane County, last year we had 98 suicides in 1 year. And those are only the ones that are confirmed by the medical examiner, where they take jurisdiction and make the determination. And it's only called suicide if there's a note, or if it was witnessed, or if there's reason to believe that they had previously been suicidal. So many end up accidental. Cause of death can be accidental or undetermined. You may or may not know that Governor Inslee created a task force to address suicide prevention as one of the statewide health problems, and the Secretary of the Department of Health is convening that. And so I'm a part of that task force. And so we're looking at the data, and what we're saying is we need to understand the quality of the data, number one, and how this is increasing. There's no question about it. The rate among veterans is astounding, and there's no other way to put it. And we were talking earlier about combining the number of suicide deaths with the number of accidental overdose deaths with opioids, including heroin, and how devastating that is. And we had 115 of those in Spokane County last year that were separate from confirmed suicides. So the impact on those 200-plus families who lost that loved one to suicide or to an accidental overdose, it's indescribable.
Many who contemplate suicide struggle with moods, with depression, and they have for years. And yet, sometimes suicide is a spur-of-the-moment thing from people who have never before considered it. Here's Tom Conis's story from our discussion.
One of my daughters was having twins this summer. We found out she had what's called twin-to-twin transference syndrome, where the umbilical cord is basically just a mess. Most all of the nutrients in the blood go into the one baby, and then after that, feed into the other baby, which puts everyone in stress, including my daughter. She was diagnosed with that, drove over to Seattle, had surgery the next day to repair that. We thought the surgery went well. Both babies seemed to be gaining weight at about the same rate, which was the real concern. She was on bed rest for 6 weeks in the hospital, and then on July 3rd, delivered 3 months early. Twins that weigh 2 pounds, 2 ounces each, Andrew and Benjamin. And it was a struggle. Being that young, their lungs were not developed well enough to be on the outside. Everything. Every day was a struggle. But they were making some progress. And about 4 weeks, Andrew took a turn, and it didn't look like he was going to come back. He had had a stroke, some pretty bad brain bleeding. And the doctors finally gave him a prognosis that he would not have any type of life. They could keep him alive for a little bit longer, but he would be a vegetable the whole time. So finally on August 15th, my daughter and son-in-law made a decision that I would never want to have had to make, to have him pulled off of everything. held him in their arms, and all of us as a family sat there and watched him pass away. A little bit after that, I went out to the parking garage at Sacred Heart, and I sat on the ledge of the parking garage, and I was ready to throw myself over that ledge because I hurt so bad. I still don't believe I wanted to die, but I wanted to end the pain. The pain was just intolerable at that point in time. Thankfully, calmer heads prevailed, or a calmer voice upstairs spoke to me, and I didn't act on it. But I even remember feeling on the way home, if I hit that telephone pole hard enough, it would take care of it.
Tom Konis is now fine. As it turns out, his wife of 40 years was experiencing some of the same feelings. They've been able to move on with their lives, as have others who experience despair. But for many, it's not so easy just to get past those kinds of obstacles. For them, thoughts of suicide come and go. And sometimes those deep feelings are really compelling, as Dr. Kevin Hyde points out. Hyde is a psychologist for Providence Healthcare in Spokane. He was a panelist for SPR's Health Forum last spring.
Suicide is not a static sort of a process. It's a dynamic process. People move in and out of crisis that may involve some sort of suicidal ideation or even suicide attempt. So the practitioner or the family member needs to remain vigilant. We know that 90% of people who attempt suicide, die by suicide, have some sort of mental illness. Only 1/3 of those are in treatment. Kind of alarming. So most of the people that struggle with suicide probably will not be in treatment, but they will be involved in families. So it's incumbent upon family members to stay vigilant.
Joe Mann and his family have tried to stay vigilant through tough times, especially after tragedy rocked the family a few years ago.
Our daughter-in-law committed suicide 2 years ago next month when her child was 2 months old. The hard part of it was, this was our youngest son. His first wife had died from diabetes, so he had lost two wives. This particular woman knew she was in trouble after the baby was born, was getting help daily, knew she had trouble. My wife, we were traveling at that time, living in our RV full time, and she flew to Minneapolis to visit 1 month after the baby was born. The doctors had warned our son, do not leave the baby alone with her. And so our focus was trying to keep her well, keep her stable, and communicate that, because my wife couldn't stay and we had to come back, and then our son's kind of by himself. And a couple of weeks later, after holding him at gunpoint for an hour, she took her life with her gun. And then our worry was him. Having lost two young wives, where was he? And it was amazing because he totally focused on his son. Totally. That grandson got all of his attention. That's what, because he had no one to help him care for his son. And so he got on with life. And that's what you have to do, whether it's by communicating and speaking out and talking about it. But if you stay in and of yourself, like Tom was talking about, where it's just you, because I've been there. After coming back and suffering some PTSD and standing in front of a gun cabinet and thinking, which one should I use? You think you're by yourself. You think there's nothing beyond where you are right then and there with that weapon. And you have to find ways, I believe, and we have to find ways to help people get beyond the here and the now in this very moment.
So how do we do that? Stacy Cornwall is the Crisis Services Director for Frontier Behavioral Health in Spokane.
Asking the question is the first step. Listening, right. I mean, there's so much that we hear from people about what has made a difference. In fact, there's this one gentleman who, it's always stuck with me, and he was someone who was on the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was on the bridge for 90-some minutes. And what he said was, the officer that had responded, the only thing he did was listen. I think he listened for like 92 minutes, and he said, that is what saved my life. He didn't tell me what I should do. He didn't try and fix it. He didn't try and, you know, shame. He didn't have any sort of judgmental tone. He wasn't imposing his own opinions. He listened. And the way he listened is he also validated. And that's a hard thing for people to make sense of when it comes to suicide if you've never experienced those thoughts yourself. And what I would say to that is you don't have to be able to relate to the situation or the suicidal ideation, but you definitely can relate to feelings of sadness or fear or hopelessness, and those are feelings that you can connect then with that individual and show that you're really validating what they're saying and that you believe them and that you want to help. And then at some point, you collaborate with them to say, what is that next step, and do you want to talk with someone further about this?
And now we finish with the couple with whom we started, Phil and Meg Tyler. Phil Tyler works security at Gonzaga University and found a way to use his experiences on campus to work through his own despair.
I think the most important conversation that he had was with the Gonzaga student who had committed suicide 5 weeks before, speaking to his father.
I reached out to a parent by the name of Philip Martin, whose son had tragically taken his life just 5 weeks prior. And I was assigned the detail to be with him and his wife at Gonzaga. And I reached out to him and we spoke on the phone. We cried. We shared stories. He guided me through this. And one of the things he told me was, do what makes you feel right. If that means talking about it, then talk about it. And I started talking about it. And what was unique, at least to me, was that people hearing the story was healing for me. And that's really what brings me here today.
You can listen to our forum on suicide and find links to resources that may help on the Inland Journal page on our website. Our thanks to Phil and Meg Tyler, to Tom Konis, to Joe Mann, Stacy Cornwall, and Kevin Hyde. We'll talk with NPR's Mara Liasson after a short break. This is Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. Mara Liasson is an integral part of NPR's political coverage. She's a national political correspondent and sometimes White House correspondent. She also provides analysis for Fox News. Next Thursday, she'll speak at the Bing in downtown Spokane at an event for Spokane Public Radio. She'll also be interviewed on stage by my colleague Steve Jackson. He had a chance this week to talk with her.
Mara Liasson served as the White House correspondent for NPR during the Clinton White House and now also shares that role occasionally with three other reporters. She talked to us about the challenges in covering the Trump administration.
Every administration is different, and the character of the administration and the White House, of course, reflects the character of the president. Donald Trump constantly is communicating with the American people through Twitter, so he makes a lot of news because when the president says something, it's news. Now, my job as a national political correspondent or a White House correspondent is to tell my listeners the difference between the truly consequential and the merely outrageous. Sometimes they're one and the same thing with him. So in that sense, it's very busy because a lot is happening. He changes his mind. Things happen in a more chaotic fashion. So in that sense, it's maybe a little bit more difficult. But I really think it's pretty much the same as covering any White House. You're trying to figure out why he's doing what he's doing. You're trying to talk to White House officials. One of the problems with the Trump White House is sometimes people literally don't know, or they think they know what he's going to do, but he's changed his mind. So that can be difficult. But, and of course, there's this permanent war that he's decided to wage on the press and the media because he thinks it's a good political thing for him to do. So we're his foil. So there's that. There's been an element of that in every White House, but he's taken it to a new level. So that's just another feature of covering this White House.
Liason says in covering the Trump White House, she often relies on leaks from White House staffers in researching a story.
A lot of times people in the White House will talk to you off the record anonymously. That's not something that's new. The difference is that this White House is not a cohesive, unified institution. People don't like each other and they say bad things about each other anonymously. And one of Donald Trump's top outside advisors told me the other day it's a miserable place to work. Because of that, that creates this atmosphere that there's a lot of leaks. There are a lot of leaks. I think that if you consider leaks to be something that's damaging or something that the administration wouldn't want to come out, there were certainly more leaks in this White House than any other one that I've ever covered.
Mara Liason says another issue nowadays is dealing with how the public has become more critical of the media.
I don't feel it has created problems for me in reporting, but I do think it is something that can be very dangerous to democracy because for the mainstream press, the press that believes it's fact-based, that tries hard every day to get it right, when we make a mistake, we correct it. To say that everything we do is fake or a lie and kind of undermining the notion that there is any such thing as objective truth and that the only I think the message sometimes from the president is you should never believe anything except for what I tell you. And that's, you know, that's not a recipe for a functioning, stable democracy. I think that Donald Trump is a stress test on democratic institutions, including the media, including the First Amendment. I think we're holding up rather well. And I don't think that it's not something that he started, but it's something that he has taken to a new level. I think people are still interested in fact-based news. Just look at the web traffic and subscription increases for all sorts of mainstream news organizations since Trump was elected. It's gone way, way up.
Mara Liason says what seems to be routine this year is the news coverage of this election cycle.
I feel that covering it is the same as covering every other election cycle that I've ever covered, with the difference, of course, that every couple of years there are innovations in media. And now it's almost easier to cover politics because any event that happens anywhere in the country, you don't have to be there on the ground. You can watch it on YouTube. So that's helpful. I think that this is a midterm election that looks like it's following the contours of every other midterm election, which is the out party is energized. The president is out campaigning for his own party. He is making the case that he's accomplished a lot, why it would be a terrible thing if his opponents got more seats in Congress. I mean, that's pretty traditional. Donald Trump is a president who has broken all sorts of norms and done away with all sorts of traditions, but I think he's acting more or less like a very conventional president in terms of his approach to the midterms. He didn't, even though some people had suggested he might, he didn't get involved in a lot of Republican primaries in an effort, for instance, to elect more anti-establishment candidates. He and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, have really been working in tandem. They want candidates that can win. That's what a traditional president does. So he's not, in other words, Donald Trump is not running the Steve Bannon playbook.
Mara Liason will be here to speak on June the 21st at the Bing. Tickets to the event are still available. That will be at 7:30 p.m. She will give a presentation and then take questions from the audience. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
That's the June 14th edition of Inland Journal, Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can find our program and stories on our Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Download a podcast of the program as well. Direct your comments to Inland Journal at kpbx.org, or you can call our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. Spokane Public Radio is listener-supported, made possible through your contributions. Thank you for your support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.